It's going to take $1 trillion to build out the network of the electric vehicle charging for the country. That capital need will scale as the demand scales. 2030, I think the first movers start to scale and the long tail starts catching up. 2040, you start to get to pretty wide scale adoption. Some of our smaller sites will be in the low tens of millions, the bigger sites in the mid tens of millions of dollars to develop one of these sites. In some of the more remote locations we're developing, you know, when we go in and we ask for 20 megawatts of power, they say, you realize the entire town that you're building this in is 2 megawatts. We are looking for land sites that really have the intersection of those three critical components: the land availability, the power availability, and customers, where there will be demand for those.
Hi, Mike. Welcome to Scaling Climate Tech.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I'm glad to be here in the Terawatt Infrastructure office in San Francisco. We're going to talk about clean energy infrastructure development and how do we build all those complicated infrastructure that we need to transition to a more electrified economy. So you're Michael Engault. You're the Chief Development Officer at Terawatt Infrastructure, a startup that own, develop, operate, and maintain charging sites in the U.S. today for commercial vehicles. So a few topics I'd like to touch upon in this conversation. One, I'd like to talk about developing large projects, projects that cost millions of dollars and takes several years to complete. Two, I'd like to talk about interconnection, which we'll see is really what it takes to put a new load on the grid. And why is that an issue when the new load is really big? And three, I'd like to talk about how do we produce clean energy for your own consumption. What does that mean in terms of technologies, solar, storage, other technologies, and all the other things that need to go around it? But before anything else, Mike, could I ask you to introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me again, Mike Engelhard with Terawatt. I am our Chief Development Officer, so I oversee everything from real estate acquisition, our energy and utility teams, our development and construction teams. So anything from finding a site, getting it entitled, finding power, getting it interconnected, and getting it turned up and built and ready to hand over to our operations team is kind of under my purview at the company. I have a very long history in real estate development, longer than I'd like to admit, in a variety of companies and sizes, from, you know, one of the largest real estate developers of industrial real estate in the world at Prologis. I was there for 10 years and led the development team for the Western U.S. I was at Aimco, which has gone through a few changes since I was there, but is a multifamily real estate developer, coast to coast, family offices, general contractors. So I've kind of had a career that has kind of spanned the gamut of real estate development and all different product types. So coming to Terawatt was really an opportunity to take a long history of a lot of different sizes of companies, a lot of different product types, a lot of different geographies, and try to bring that to a new company starting to develop a new product.
Super exciting. And we'll see how your experience is incredibly relevant for this company. Let's start with the problem you're solving. So you're focusing on medium and heavy duty transportation. We know that a quarter of emission from transportation come from this medium and heavy duty segments. There's been over the last year, various new trucks coming out that are electrified and the adoption is coming. It's coming slowly though. Do you have some numbers on, because we hear a lot about the new models coming out. We hear about pilot programs, dozens, 50 trucks being adopted, but we're not quite seeing yet the mass adoption that we're seeing on light duty vehicles. So could you talk a bit about where we are today?
We're still in the very beginning on adoption. Most companies now are kind of in their pilot, try it to see if they like it phase, see how they can shift their operations, or do they have to shift their operations to electrify their fleets. Companies are trying a handful of trucks, you know, in the largest cases, maybe 20 to 50 trucks. So it's still in the very, very early stages. There are, you know, a few thousand Class 8 battery electric vehicles on the road today.
And Class 8 are those semi trucks?
The big semis, yes. There's a differentiation even amongst those trucks of day cabs, trucks that are doing local routes, and sleeper cabs, trucks that are doing kind of long haul travel. In the US today, there is not a sleeper cab truck from battery electric vehicles that is readily available for the public. So companies are, you know, still experimenting in short haul, light duty cycle, big vehicles, but the drayage industry in particular around ports, intermodal facilities, picking up goods and taking them to a distribution warehouse somewhere that they're sorted and shipped elsewhere is the biggest use today. There's also, we're seeing a lot of use in the food and beverage industry for local distribution of companies that are running the same route every day. And that route may be 50, 60 miles and they make 10 stops delivering drinks or food goods to grocery stores, retailers, and they have a set route and a lower duty cycle of numbers for days or miles per day. So that use case fits really well for the battery electric trucks today.
So we're starting with the easiest use cases in terms of like smaller distance and many stops.
Yes.
That makes sense. And one of the reasons we're not seeing this mass adoption yet is concerns probably, or as you said, we're more in a pilot stage from fleets in terms of, will I be able to electrify seamlessly in terms of range of my truck, but also in terms of availability of charging stations. So really the same problems we had for electric cars 10 years ago. I mean, we still have this issue in some areas for sure, but it is being solved. I was checking some numbers on passenger vehicle charging station. We have 70,000 charging stations in the US today. It's been an incredible development over the last years. I believe the number of commercial trucking stations is in the dozens, maybe, but it is a very, very small number, right? Out of which several are terawatts. That has created a bit of a chicken and egg problem where the fleets are waiting for the charging station to come. The charging station are waiting for the fleets to come because otherwise your asset doesn't have revenues there. And this is where Terawatt comes in. Could you give me a sense of where you are today? The company was created in 2021. I'd love to understand where you are in terms of operational sites, for instance.
We have our first two sites, which I mentioned earlier, are light duty sites for fleet passenger vehicles. First one comes on is complete, interconnected, comes online next week. The second one is in San Francisco, where construction complete. As you mentioned, interconnection, waiting for our final interconnection to be able to turn that on. Beyond that, we have a site under construction near the port of Long Beach in Rancho Dominguez, which will be online later this year. We have another site in Rialto in the Inland Empire of California, which starts construction in the coming weeks, which will be online near the end of the year. Two more in kind of permitting phases where construction will start towards the end of this year. So that'll be our first four sites fully under construction. Two of those will be online near the end of this year, early next year. In the following two in the late spring, early summer of 2025. In total, we have 15 sites under development for heavy-duty truck charging, primarily in California, a few sites, as we have previously announced, along the I-10 corridor, two in Arizona and two in New Mexico. And then beyond that, we have a very active pipeline of additional sites that are in early planning stages in acquisitions. We have about 8 more acquisitions that we intend to close on new land sites this year still. So we have a pretty robust pipeline. In total, Terawatt owns about 60 sites in 19 states. Some of those corridor sites along prime corridors will be a little further to develop as trucks coming online for long haul are further out on the horizon.
So I'll be a bit provocative here, but help me understand. On the one hand, you raise $1 billion in funding and you've been operational for more or less 3 years. You have an A team, really, in terms of executive team and the CEO, yourself and others that have a tremendous experience. On the other hand, you've developed less than 10 sites. So help me understand, why does it take so long? Because capital is not the issue, apparently. And in the startup world, 3 years is an incredible amount of time. So help me understand, what does it take for a project, let's focus on a heavy-duty electric charging station, to be operational? And as we go through that, we'll probably understand why it takes more than 1 or 2 years to make this go live. It would be really helpful if we can start with, let's take an average site somewhere in California, somewhere in Arizona, and take it from the decision that you will make a site here to actually this site being ready for a truck to plug there.
So the first step in the whole process is finding the land, and finding land where, you know, we're really looking for an intersection of three critical components when we're looking for land. One is available land, something that, you know, we can buy to develop. The second is where there's power in relatively near term, and relatively near term in utility timeframe for what we're doing. from start to finish in a fast scenario is about 18 months. And then the third is where customers are. Where are there going to be trucks? So we are looking for land sites that really have the intersection of those three critical components, the land availability, the power availability, and customers, where there will be demand for those. We have built a land mapping base that we can look at customers' locations. We have some telematic data of vehicle routes. So we can look at, take vehicle route data. Some of it's public. Some of it, you can buy the data. Some of it is shared with us from our customers. So we can overlay truck traffic data, customer locations, electric substations, electric circuit capacity, and then plot land availability on there. So that is a mapping tool that we have built in-house, yes. That takes some time to find that site and to find that combination, especially at the power levels that we're needing to develop these sites. So there, we're looking for additional sites in the greater LA area and in a couple prime submarkets. We've been looking for land for 2 years. And when you're building in infill markets where, you know, trucks are making the short haul routes today, these are, in most cases, already developed areas. So we are looking for infill sites. We're looking for functionally obsolete buildings that we can take down that have a higher and better use for the land site.
That makes sense in the urban environment. I can imagine the LA area, it's really hard to find a massive parking lot for 20 trucks with the additional electrical capacity. Is that true as well in a more rural corridor? You mentioned you're in the I-10, which connects California to Texas, essentially. I imagine there's a lot of empty land there that's ready for purchase.
Land is easier to come by. You get into those rural areas and one, you know, truck traffic needs to be there. And more importantly, electric truck traffic needs to be there, which we're not finding on interstate travel yet. And then the, you know, the last component that I mentioned of the three is power. And you get into the rural areas and you're not going to find a substation in the middle of the desert along the I-10 corridor to provide the power. So finding that, again, the three, land, power, and customer. Yes, land is easier to come by along the corridors and for a much better price than we're paying for land in these more urban settings. But the timing for the trucks to get there and the timing to get power in some cases is a much longer horizon.
Got it. So you have some tools, maps, modeling where you identify this potential sites, then you actually engage with the owners, the utilities to prioritize them until eventually you close on some sites. In itself, a fairly long process.
Yeah, and that can take, you know, on the fast side from identifying a market, identifying a land site, working with the utilities, doing our land due diligence. You know, that's 120 to 180 day cycle from identifying of a land site to acquiring it in a normal kind of middle of the road cycle for us. From there, then it is engaging with the utility. We've done this during our due diligence, but until we submit a full plan, our power isn't contracted for the utility. So it takes a little bit of time to design the site to get about a 30% complete design package to the utility. Well, they will then start their design and start their process for interconnection. That process with the utility will take anywhere from 12 to 24 months on a normal cycle.
Okay. I'll put a pin on that one because I think that's a whole topic on its own. I'd love to go back to. Let's just say for now, it's a 24-month process with utility magically happens somehow. What comes after that?
So somewhat concurrent with that, we're designing our site. We are designing our sites, I would say average in the 10 to 12 megawatt of power range on a site. Low end, we may be in the 5 to 7. In the high end, we may be 20 to 25 megawatts. So there's some variability in the size based on, you know, area of land that we have and power that's available or might be available in the future on the grid.
Mm-hmm. So these are your engineers making the blueprint, the design, how many chargers, where, what are the cables going and so on?
One of the kind of more critical components, these are very, very high powered sites. We're bringing in electricity at much higher voltages than a normal building would take into the site. So we're into medium to high voltages coming to the site. And so most of our sites are built with medium voltage switchgear. From the time that we start the procurement process of that switchgear to delivery for the industry now on average is about 80 weeks. So the one critical component, switchgear, The other one is transformers. Lead times for those is over a year from when you have it designed to delivery on site. There's just a huge backlog for those electrical components from things like data centers, the AI explosion, automation of warehouses, automation of buildings, life sciences, and now the electrification of buildings.
And these have got better over the last year because during COVID, it was even worse. But as you say, it's still a very long lead time to actually get those components.
You know, at one point, it was almost 2 years to get these components. They've come down and we have done some things to shorten that time frame. But that is a long lead piece of equipment. You know, then you move into the site permitting process and you go meet with a city or a county and you say, I want to build this. And I say, we've never heard of that before. I say, you're right. It's something new. And they say, we don't have a zoning code for that. There's nothing in our zoning documents that highlight where you can build certain things within a city that has that use case. And I said, no, it hasn't existed. So the default is they call us a fueling station. And we don't want to be categorized as a fueling station for a lot of reasons. But cities also, you know, generally don't want fueling stations. So the approval cycle is long to get through zoning to get entitlement to build one of these.
It is long because of the back and forth with the municipality to understand what document, what permit needs to happen.
It is more their process, one, to understand what it is. And then you go through public hearings and planning commission review and city council review. And all of those just take time.
Is there a position against charging stations? We hear a lot about opposition for solar. People don't want land to be taken up by solar. I can understand why there's opposition for pipelines. Charging stations sounds like it's fairly smaller in terms of footprints and less impactful in the environment. I'm curious how this is perceived by the communities.
You know, every time we go talk to a city, we say, this is what we're doing. This is what we want to build. And they said, oh, that's fantastic. We'd love to have that. We don't know how to do that. We don't have a process in our playbook that accounts for fleet, you know, electric vehicle charging centers. That's coming. States trying to do a lot of work to accelerate that. But cities, every city has their own codes and their own governance. So states have some influence, but not as much as you would think over how the cities view these. There are some cities, like City of Ontario we met with, and we said, we want this. And they said, we want it too. We understand it. And it is a by right development in industrial areas. There's no zoning and planning process. You go to the next city over and they say, we've never thought about this before. So, you know, what is basically a by right process in one city and the next city can take 9 months to get through an entitlement process.
I had a very similar discussion with Keithy Hannon from Dandelion Energy for geothermal heat pumps, where it is a very similar problem, where every county, every municipality has its own permitting process. So I hear the complexity basically that your team is facing, adapting to that every time. Okay, so you're doing the permitting in parallel to the ordering of the different components, in parallel to the interconnection. So all of this is taking 1-2 years, all happening in parallel. Once all of this is complete, you can start construction.
Yes. Once all permits are in place, once all of your long lead time equipment is in place, then you know, you're engaging contractors and there's the other component that we haven't talked about, which is the actual charger itself. Lead times for those aren't as long, but they have some lead time to them. So that's in the early procurement phase also. And then you move to construction, and construction for our sites will take anywhere from 5 to 8 months, depending on the size of the site. So when you go from land acquisition through working with the utility, permitting, long lead equipment, you're getting pretty close to a 3-year cycle.
Okay. Hence why the sites are about to be complete from 2021. That makes perfect sense. These sites are massive in terms of power output. Could you help me understand the typical cost and how that cost breaks down for a site? You know, if we take like a 20 stall, for instance, site in a rural area, how much is acquisition? How much are the equipment? How much is interconnection cost? Like, how does that break down typically?
It really varies site by site. You know, you mentioned a rural location. We might be buying a 5-acre parcel of land in a rural area for $500,000 or $1 million. A parcel the same size in a urban area where trucks are being deployed today might be 15. So lots of variability in land depending on location. Even in more developed areas, you go further east in Southern California, away from the port out to the Inland Empire, and land is a third of the cost of what is closer to the port in the more dense urban areas. So land is a huge variable cost. Interconnection is a huge variable cost. It depends on how close you are to the substation, if the substation has capacity, if the circuit serving the area has capacity, and then which incentives or kind of rules that the utility has, Rule 15, Rule 16, Rule 29, which is all how they go about calculating interconnection cost. And they will take, you know, their assumed revenue from the site for selling electricity and factor that into how much they will offer in allowances that they will cover for the cost of the interconnection, and then what's left we pay for. And we've had some cases where interconnection costs us zero, and we have had some cases where interconnection will cost us multiple millions of dollars. So that is also a huge variable that is dependent on the infrastructure that's in place and what's available to serve the site and how much power we're requesting. So that 10 megawatt site, 20 chargers, a 3-acre-ish parcel of land can vary by multiple millions of dollars depending on where it is, where power is. So knowing, you know, the jurisdiction, requirements, power, utilities, cost of land, all of those are huge variables in the cost of delivering our site. There are a few components, things like fences, the buildings we put on the site, the electrical gear, and the chargers that are fairly fixed, but that typically is less than half the cost of the development of the site that is more fixed.
Got it. So what would be the price tag for, or like the range of price tag for a site? I'm just trying to understand because, you know, a charger at home is a few hundred dollars. A charging station, passenger vehicle is going to be thousands or dozens of thousands. Here, I think we're talking more in the 50 million range.
That would be on the high end of the scale. You know, some of our smaller sites will be in the low tens of millions to the bigger sites in the mid tens of millions of dollars to develop one of these sites. And again, it depends on the size of the site, and our sizes of sites have some variability as well.
Okay, so let's remove this pin on interconnect. I think we need to talk about this. You mentioned the variability, and it's a critical component in the total cost stack. So let's deep dive on this. For most of us, the electric grid is just this thing. We plug something, we plug a kettle in, it works. And that's how it's supposed to, it's designed to work. It works, it's as low cost as possible. And that's true because the load we're plugging in is a small load. The moment we start plugging in something bigger, it has trickle-down effects on the rest of the grid. And just to give a sense of magnitude, I think you mentioned 10 megawatt, 15 megawatt. You know, a kettle is 1 kilowatt, more or less. Electric truck battery is 1 megawatt hour, more or less. And therefore, your charger, when you're doing 10 or 15 stalls, you're trying to have this 10, 15, 20 megawatt capacity there. So it's 1,000 more than a kettle, right? And just to give a sense of magnitude again, 20 megawatt is the equivalent of a major Olympic stadium or twice the capacity of the Empire State Building. So when you are putting somewhere in Arizona, a charging station, in the middle of a highway corridor, you're essentially putting 2 Empire State Building there. So we can understand that the grid has not been designed to support 2 Empire State Building there. So help me understand what happens with the utility and what happens on the network when you actually go out to them and say, we would like to connect 20 megawatt there. What does the utility need to develop? And as you mentioned earlier, what do you need either you or the utility to pay for in terms of network improvements?
So at the highest level, this goes all the way back to the transmission infrastructure. So you have, you know, the load at a site that goes back to a substation, and the substation is fed from a generation plant. So, you know, transmission goes from the generation plant to the substations.
And just the substation is the device that essentially changes the voltage, where generator operates at high voltage and the distribution grid operates at lower voltage. So you have those substation that move from high to low or low to high, depending on the need.
Yeah, and it will break it up regionally to take that load, put it into more bite-sized pieces, and then distribute that out to nearby locations. So, you know, as we look at our sites, we first look at the circuit that the site is served by, and is there anything available on the circuit? And circuits will have capacity, you know, in the single to low double-digit megawatts on a single circuit. Substation will have tens of megawatts of capacity, and then transmission generation plants, your gigawatts of capacity. So you know, as you follow that down, you look at, all right, what's serving the substation? Can the substation even handle our load? And in some of the more remote locations like we're developing in New Mexico, you know, when we go in and we ask for 10 megawatts scaling to 20 megawatts of power, they say, you realize the entire town that you're building this in is 2 megawatts. So in most cases, we will have to do upgrades to the local circuit. In a lot of cases, we will have to do upgrades to the substation. And in some locations, just there isn't even the transmission capacity that is available in the area to serve off our full load. It is a use of electricity that was not contemplated when our electric grids were built 100 years ago. And the electric grids, they were built 100 years ago. There have been some moderate upgrades to those grids, but the advancement of electrified things has accelerated so much faster than the grids are able to keep up with that almost in every scenario, we're finding ourselves having to do some amount of upgrade to circuits or substations to power those sites. So that takes a long time.
Right. Because as you said, the ideal situation is you arrive, there's 20 megawatts available capacity at the circuit and substation level, life is perfect, and you just plug in.
We have found that once.
Oh, I was going to say, that never happens.
We found it once.
Why would there be 20 megawatt available?
You know, in some cases, there was major manufacturing or a major load in the area that had recently gone away. Manufacturing moves, something closed down, some major load shifted.
So that was the zero cost. You must have been pretty happy about that one.
That one was a great find, yes.
Yes, but generally, you don't have that 20 megawatt. So you go there, talk to the utility, whoever is the local utility. They make an assessment of the impact on the grid. So everything you explain in terms of what is the impact on the circuit, what is the impact on the substation, and so on and so forth. And then they put a number on that. They say, if I need to upgrade my circuit for you, this is how much it costs. If I need to upgrade my substation for you, this is how much it costs. Then there's a question of who pays for that, right? If the total bill is $100 million, because you need to upgrade the substation from 10 megawatt to 50 megawatt. It's not just for you. So depending on the jurisdiction, there are rules where either the load fully pays for that upgrade, the load doesn't pay for that upgrade, or any version in between those two. Can you give me a sense, high level, of how does that work, or is it really a case-by-case basis?
It's very much case-by-case basis. They will look for, you know, as you said, we may not be the benefactor of everything that they have to do to upgrade something. So that falls into a betterment category where if it's a investor-owned utility like Southern California Edison or PG&E, that becomes part of their rate case and their rate base where ratepayers will pay for upgrades that are needed to serve a entire area. We may be an off-taker of some of that. If we're an off-taker of some of that, we would pay our share of that. The rest would go to betterment.
Right. Through your rates, you would pay your share.
Yes. Yeah. Or in a lot of cases, we pay our share through having to actually write a check. It doesn't all get baked into our rate that we pay on site. There's a lot of cases where to develop, you know, we need to write a check and we need to pay for those advancements and or those improvements. And similar to what we, you know, are developing on our site, when a substation needs to be upgraded, then they're needing transformers. They're needing much larger transformers than we're putting on our sites. And where we may have to wait, you know, the 80 months we talked about for a transformer, the utility may have to wait 3 years for that same transformer. So to scale, you know, our loads will scale as trucks are become more prevalent on the road. So, you know, the utility will scale with us and, you know, it may take them 3 or 4 years to get our full load to our site. But in a lot of cases, it will be 3 or 4 years before that full load is getting interconnected on our site as well.
Right. And so this is why when we said earlier, it takes 12 to 24 months. And I'm actually surprised that it's that little. I was thinking it's even longer to interconnect your electric station to the grid. This is because the utility is making this analysis, is making the cost allocation, and then is actually making the investment to upgrade everything on the circuit level and the substation level to make it work the day you plug in.
Yeah. And to clarify, the 12 to 24 months is for our initial load. So that may be, you know, 3, 5, 7 megawatts. We may get another 10 megawatts 3 years later and another 5 megawatts 2 years after that.
And you'll have to do the same process again.
I mean, to get the later phases of our development, we're starting that process the same day. But equipment, you know, like I mentioned, if they need a transformer at the substation, it takes them 3 years to get it. And it's only serving our site. We're funding that. And so we're writing those checks as they're placing the orders for the equipment.
Got it. One way not to do this interconnection, or at least to make it easier, is on-site generation. I'd love to talk about that and the trade-off essentially between two models of getting electricity, which is, one is called front of the meter, which is everything we've been talking about so far, which is getting electricity from the utility directly. The challenge with that is first interconnection, but also the cost of electricity, because then you're not only paying for the generation of the electricity, but you're also paying for the use of the network, the transmission and distribution network. And that is actually a very sizable piece of the rates. If we look just at California, it's nearly 50% of the rates are in the use of the transmission distribution network. So if you can avoid using it, you're avoiding the interconnection issue and you're avoiding 50% of the cost as well. The other model is what's called behind the meter. So this on-site generation, which means that you have producing assets on the ground where your chargers are. And this is actually what people do when they do rooftop solar. If you put a solar panel in your home, it is behind the meter and you're just consuming the electrons that you're producing on your roof. Help me understand the trade-off between this behind the meter and front of the meter. I understand that in the middle of Los Angeles, you're not going to put a 20-acre solar farm for sure. But on the side of a corridor in Arizona or some state that is very favorable to solar, why would you not always do on-site generation and storage?
We are planning to do a fair amount of it on our corridor sites. It is still costly to do. You not only have the generation, but then you have to store it. So then you have battery on site. Reliability of the grid, it does have its issues, and there are momentary lapses in service from the grid. But the reliability of a grid is far better than behind the meter type generation. Weather things happen with batteries. So there is some variability to the reliability of behind the meter. So where available and where interconnection is at a reasonable cost before the meter generation from the utility is the preferred method. When you get into either very lengthy interconnections from a time standpoint where there's nothing available on the grid and it's going to take us 4 years to get any power to our site, then some forms of on-site generation start to get interesting. Or if there just isn't any capacity, like sites we have in New Mexico or Arizona, we generally have enough grid capacity, then on-site generation becomes more interesting. But as you said, it takes a lot of land to build a ground mount solar farm. Takes about 4 acres of land per megawatt of power.
Got it. 20 megawatts, 80 acres. Acre is more or less a football field. So that's 80-ish football field for one charging station.
Yes. And then the batteries to support all of that, which a 2 megawatt hour battery is about the size of a shipping container. So as you think, okay, 80 megawatts and 1 megawatt to 2 megawatt hours of storage, and you start getting up there and, you know, 160 of these batteries, the batteries are still fairly expensive. It gets to be a sizable investment.
So now we understand how you build a site. We understand why it might take quite a long time to actually interconnect and how you got to those 10, 15 sites. I'd love to deep dive on another main bottleneck of electrification, which is the charging speed. We haven't talked too much about it so far, but trucks have those huge batteries, megawatt level batteries. And so if we keep charging them like we are today, at 250 kilowatt, 350 kilowatt, it takes several hours to do that, which, as you mentioned, is feasible for short distance because you don't need to fuel up the entire tank, but it is not feasible for long haul. There are two standards of charging today. One is called the combined charging system, the CCS, which is those 250, 350 kilowatt chargers, which, by the way, are the same as we have for passenger vehicles. And then there's this new standard, which is called the megawatt charging system. So megawatt capability, meaning that you can charge theoretically up to 3.75 megawatt, which is an insane capacity for a charger. And if we're able to reach that, or at least some way to that at the megawatt level, it would bring down the charging time to half an hour or maybe even less for a truck. So now you're getting into the zone where it might make sense for a long haul because it's sort of matching the typical stop time of a trucker. I understand these megawatt capabilities are not yet available but are emerging. How are you seeing this changing the industry and potentially the adoption curve for trucking?
Yeah, I think that this is the real gating item to widespread acceptance. And this unlocks longer range. It reduces a lot of the, you know, range anxiety that people that drive electric vehicles may have, fear of being stuck somewhere or not getting somewhere, or not having locations to stop and charge. So being able to deliver huge electrical charges, 500 mile range into a battery in a half an hour, really starts to unlock those longer routes. And this is what will really kind of, I think, spur the widespread adoption. There are two sides of that. One is the charger. Being able to deliver that many electrons that fast isn't something that the technology is crazy to think is here. Mylint in Europe just tested their first MCS chargers a couple of weeks ago. And so that is coming. There are other industries, locomotives for trains, you know, stuff with ships are delivering electrons at that capacity. And so, you know, the ability to deliver on a 1,000-volt or 1,500-volt system, megawatt-level charging, with a little bit of concerted effort and organization amongst the industry to even agree upon what the MCS standard is, isn't far-fetched to have done in the very, very near term. The other component of that is the vehicle's ability to accept electrons that fast. And to have, you know, you can have more batteries that can hold that much, but the voltage of the architecture of those batteries is the other gating factor. And that one is probably the longer lead time in this adoption of charger and vehicle, both being able to accept megawatt level charging. So hopefully the batteries in the vehicles, you know, we're hearing that it's a 2027, 2028-ish timeframe. Hopefully that accelerates as demand increases for these, but that's about the time frame on the vehicle side to be able to accept it is what we're hearing.
So that's really the technical capability of the battery to accept it. And I think the technical term here is the C rating of the battery. So how fast the battery can charge or discharge. And for passenger vehicle, I think it's about the C rating is 2 to 3, meaning that, you know, if you have a Tesla, you can charge at 250 kilowatts. It's a 80 kilowatt battery. It's actually 3x that. And it depends on a lot of things, the battery chemistry, the ability to dissipate heat and so on. And so what you're saying is that the charger needs to be able to deliver that 1 megawatt, but then the battery from a capability perspective needs to be able to receive that load effectively. And that might take a bit longer from the truck manufacturers to get it right. How do you develop a site so that it is ready for this new standard? You design it for a 250 or 350 kilowatt today. So everything that the charges themselves first are designed for that. The on-site generation interconnection are designed for that. How do you make sure it's ready for this next wave that will be coming in a few years?
Space. So we need to design our electrical equipment to take that kind of voltage. We need to design our sites to have room to expand. So if we're bringing in 5 megawatts of power today and that scales to 15 megawatts, we will need multiple series of the switchgear and the other electrical equipment on site. So we need to design the space for it and space plan for it. The other piece is the pathway to get the electrical wires from the electrical gear on site to the charger. As that voltage increases and you move up to the megawatt level charging, you need more pathway for the cables to get there. So those are all things that we're planning into our sites today, putting in extra capacity in the pathways to get to where the chargers will sit, putting in room on our sites to expand our electric gear as the power delivered to the site expands. So we plan for the end state of, you know, megawatt level charging and kind of design backwards to make sure that we have the capacity in the pathways and in the land to get there.
Okay. The space and having this modular so you could almost add another unit of chargers when need be. Fascinating. Let me change gear a bit from site development to TerraWatt as a company. I'd love to talk about the business model because as we saw, these projects take a very long time. They're very capital intensive, which is why you raise $1 billion. And until you have a customer, you don't have revenues. So could we start by understanding what the business model of TerraWatt is? How do you make money? Do you just charge the customer like any Tesla charger based on the energy being used? Or is there a different format or a different revenue model?
We have a few different ways that we operate. We do have kind of the basic energy usage model. You come, you plug in, and what you use, we bill you for. We are typically working with fleets. So we're on a contract basis. So they have a pre-negotiated rate with us. They have a term of their contract. one of the things that's different about our sites is we are private or semi-private, meaning that you have to be part of our network to come charge on our sites. And part of our network can be very broad, just a subscription to use, like, you know, maybe a gym membership where if you have a membership at a gym, you can go to any one of their locations. But the big reason for us is these vehicles that take longer to charge, even you're seeing it in public charging, you go to any one of the public charging sites, and if there's a line of four cars when you pull up, most times you leave and you go to find a different location. For trucks, if their wheels aren't turning, they aren't making money. And if it takes an hour to charge one of these vehicles and they pull up and they're third in line, that just doesn't work for their business model. So to be in our network means that you have the ability to reserve a stall on one of our sites to charge. We can then have a reservation-based system where you can reserve a stall and you can come in and you can have a subscription that says this is your rate to charge at this facility, or others that know that they're going to have a bunch of trucks going this in through this location. They may say, I want a dedicated stall. I want two stalls that are for my fleet's use only, and I'll cycle as many vehicles as I can through there in a day. And in that scenario, they pay us a lease rate, basically like you would for any other real estate. And this is probably most similar to like cold storage industry where you're leasing volume. They're leasing a lane on our site or a couple, and then they're cycling their trucks through, and then they pay the energy component of that above and beyond the lease payment. So that is a second way that people can contract with us.
On the energy side, is there a time of use rate? Is there a flat rate? If you come in the middle of the day where solar generating, you'll have a much lower rate than if you go in the middle of the night, for instance.
It depends on your energy source, and it depends on the utility and their time of use tariffs that they add on. In Southern California, with Southern California Edison, their peak period is from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. And so that's when energy users pay the most from the utility. So that translates to the rate that our customers have when they're on site. So there's typically peak, off peak, and sometimes a mid peak rate. So our rates will fluctuate on that. Where, you know, we may have some ability to game that a little bit is with battery, where if on off peak hours at 10 a.m. till 3 p.m., we don't have as many vehicles coming through the site, electricity is the cheapest for us to buy then. We may take that time and fill batteries. And then when a vehicle comes at 5 p.m. when electricity is most expensive, we're dispensing from the battery rather than from the grid.
Right. And it's probably something underappreciated is that you're not operating exactly like a passenger charging station where people just come in and charge. You have a fairly fixed schedule almost where fleets are operating in a very consistent way from a port. So you know that this truck will be here at this given time almost every single day of the week. So that's also why you can't just open up the network to everybody to come in.
Yes. And that was one of the things that planners a few years ago didn't fully take into effect. And we've had a lot of talks with utilities, and they said trucks will just change their duty cycles based on our time of use, and they'll charge when electricity is cheap and we have more capacity. And we said, no, because they have to deliver to a grocery store and their window is between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. That's the constraint, not the electricity. Or the port is open from, you know, these hours to these hours, and they have to go meet delivery timeframes at their end destination. That is way more of a driving factor than little variances in energy rates. Those variances will add up, but not to the extent that changing their whole duty cycle will affect how they operate their business.
That makes sense. To the extent you're comfortable, can you give me a sense of the revenue trajectory? I mean, as long as you don't have any charging network operational yet, that's zero. But I'm just curious to understand, you know, what a typical charger might generate in terms of revenues, and how does that scale up?
That is not stuff that we have published, and not rates that we have out for public consumption. But if you think on capacity and you think of a public charging network and what you pay for electricity there, we're at a discount to that because it's just higher volume. So it is less than you would pay at public charging. And you know, I think that that varies somewhere between 46 and 55 cents a kilowatt hour, depending on the network. We will be at a discount to that for sure. But that is not something that we have published today on what our rates are. And then again, revenue will be very dependent on the demand that happens at the sites and the utilization that we have at our sites.
So let me do some math, and you only need to nod or not.
And you can't see me nod on a podcast.
Exactly. So this will be confidential, but I underappreciated how much revenue could a single site generate. And I mean, it makes sense because the energy capacity is huge and your revenues are directly tied to energy. But let's just take a simple site of 20 chargers. Again, let's assume they're megawatt ready. So 1 megawatt capacity per charger. So you're able to deliver 20 megawatt hour per hour. You're not going to use the charger 100% of the time. So let's assume 30% utilization rates. I can see you nodding. So that's 8 hours a day. You can probably do better if you optimize with your customers and different routes and so on. So 8 hours a day, 20 megawatt hour is 160 megawatt hour per day of energy delivered, which on its own is huge.
Yeah.
The rates are not public, but as you mentioned, 40 cents is the more like the retail for a passenger vehicle. Let's call it 30 cents per kilowatt hour. So $300 per megawatt hour multiplied by 160 megawatt hour, that is $50,000 per day in revenue from the energy. I'm putting aside any leasing or other things I might have. So annually, that's over $10 million in revenue per charger. So that is quite an impressive number, specifically given, you know, you mentioned that there's a wide variance of cost to build those networks. But I think it's a good anchor number to understand that a charging station for heavy duty is $10 million, meaning that if you have 10 of them, you're already reaching $100 million. If you have 100 charging stations, which is sizable, but compared to the network of passenger vehicle chargers, not that big, that is already $1 billion in revenues. Margin is a separate topic, right? But at least in revenues, you can scale very quickly with that business model already.
Your logic is correct. There may be some variance in the numbers, but the logic of how you went about solving it is correct.
What influences site profitability? Is it just utilization, the cost to develop that site, the local electricity rates? What are the main drivers there?
If you look at net operating income, which is key factor, especially for real estate, that you're valuing a real estate development from, the two biggest drivers of your net operating income are going to be utilization and rate. And so the variabilities of those will have huge swings in your net operating income. So the higher we push up utilization on our sites, the better that is to the bottom line.
And the utilization, you can probably optimize more than passenger vehicles, right? Because as we mentioned, passenger vehicle, you're a bit passive, you're waiting for cars to come, but you're proactively engaging with customers, understanding their route is somewhat predictable. So I imagine that this 30% number can be significantly optimized by, as you mentioned, finding the right sites first to make sure it's on the routes, but also contracting with the right customers. Because you have this predictability, you can probably reach much higher numbers there.
In theory. Yeah, we'll see when that many trucks get on the road.
Right. The adoption is another issue.
Theoretically, yes.
Okay, so very scalable business model. The one challenge is capital. These are costly sites, and as you mentioned, the adoption curve takes a while, so you have to bear this cost until the customers materialize. Interestingly, TerraWatt comes from a private equity company, Keyframe Capital, that identified this opportunity back in 2018, I believe, and they went ahead to purchase some of the sites that you have in your portfolio today, so that was very foreseeing of them. You raised $100 million in 2021, you raise another $1 billion in 2022. And that is because you're owning the assets. You're owning the land, you're owning the chargers, and you're operating it afterwards. What are the trade-off between that vertically integrated model where you're owning everything and something more separated, like in the solar industry, for instance? In the solar industry, typically you will have an EPC company, so somebody that will construct the solar field. And then you'll have somebody else owning the land and owning the assets. What is your perspective on the trade-off between the two and how well they can scale?
It is a very capital-intensive business. And I think that some of the numbers that have been thrown around is, you know, it's going to take close to $1 trillion by 2040 to build out the network of the electric vehicle charging for the country.
Is that for the commercial trucking or?
For all.
All of it. $1 trillion. Okay.
By 2040 to build out this network. So lots of opportunity for investment. You know, when we look at it from how we develop from buying the land, developing it, owning it, and operating it, it looks a lot like a real estate investment. And when you look at real estate investors that are at large scales for a stabilized industry, we're not there yet, but we'll get there on this product type. There are trillions and trillions of dollars invested in real estate from life companies and companies like Blackstone and BlackRock and all the other big real estate investment companies. So I think that if you can demonstrate stable operating income, longer term recurring contracts. We can do that by owning and operating the sites. That gives us the stability to make this a more mainstream type of investment. So from our view, that's important to us. It does require a lot of capital, which is, you know, why we raised $1 billion. But as you went through your math on how many sites that develops, it's not as many as you think. There will be need for future investments. But I think that when the industry is proven, vehicles are at scale, revenue is stable and recurring, there will be lots of equity looking to invest in this product type. And so that's why we're going about it as we are, to really establish this as a true asset class and make it resemble something as close to what is out there in the world today. And probably the closest would be either new emerging classes of real estate would be data centers and cold storage. You know, we're providing something similar. It's a capital intensive real estate investment, and we're selling capacity that marries very similar to what they do on data center and cold storage developments as well.
What is the long-term vision for TerraWatt? You mentioned those 10 sites, $1 billion. So you probably still have some cash remaining to do more sites, but not that many. How many sites are you looking at in the coming, you know, 5 to 10 years? And how many do you think are needed in the US to fully electrify the heavy-duty trucking?
It is going to scale rapidly as deployment of vehicles scales. If you look at technology-related advancements and the scale of which they advance, you look at the history of a cell phone for the last 30 years, it's pretty significant in the advancements. This is a technology also. I mean, these trucks now are computers. The chargers are computers. They have a different function than a cell phone, but you know, this is technology-based. And so costs will come down, adoption will scale. We're seeing it on the passenger vehicle side. That capital need will scale as the demand scales. I think as we get to the 2028, it goes from pilots and tests to more broad adoption. And then you'll go from, you know, those on the bleeding edge that are the ones that drive initial discovery of how things work. Pepsi is one that's very public with their journey down trying their vehicles. They're out on that bleeding edge. Then, you know, you get the first movers that are in pilot stages now. So, you know, when things are commercially available at scale, they're ready to move. And then you get the long tail of the industry. 2030, I think the first movers start to scale and the long tail starts catching up. 2040, you start to get to pretty wide scale adoption. So the demand of capital will scale similarly over the coming years and decade and a half to get there.
So it's essentially what's happening for passenger vehicle with a good decade of, you know, delay, or 10 or 15 years of delay versus passenger vehicles.
Yeah, I think that it will scale much faster than passenger vehicles. Passenger vehicles have proven that it works. They have proven that, you know, there's the use case for it. People are comfortable with it. I think that the trucks will scale much faster. But there's, you know, a natural life cycle of the vehicles that are on the road today. So as you look at, as those phase out, you know, they may have a 10-year useful life for these semis. So over the next 10 years, as those start to phase out and start getting replaced with more and more electric vehicles, I think the adoption happens much faster. But to get to the scale that we're at with passenger vehicles, it's probably another 10-year journey to get there.
Okay. Do you have a sense of how many chargers would need to be deployed to enable that?
I haven't backed into the number of chargers, but you know, looking at capital needs when the market kind of hits maturity in 2040, again, you know, you're approaching $1 trillion. So you know, you can back that math out. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of chargers. And if you look at, I haven't done the math on this either, but if you look at how many truck stops there are in the United States and those get replaced with these types of facilities, it's thousands and thousands of facilities that will be needed to meet the needs of the fleets.
Right. And how can you scale the TerraWatt business model? Because you're still a project company. You have to manage every project individually. You probably have a fairly good playbook by now based on the experience across 10 sites. So you've streamlined and standardized different things. But like real estate, every location is different from the grid perspective, from the construction perspective. How do you scale from making, you know, 10 projects in 2-3 years, maybe making 100? Is that just more project manager, more engineers distributed throughout the country? And does that scale effectively?
it can scale, not to the extent that I think that we ultimately need to get to for Terawatt. From a Terawatt perspective, if you look at, I mean, my experience with other companies that I've worked at, Prologis and Aimco doubled in size every 18 months for the first 5 years of its existence. That was all through acquisition of other companies, other portfolios. Prologis has scaled similarly. They've taken down some of their largest competitors through acquisitions. So I think that winners and losers will emerge, but I think that it's going to take a lot of people developing sites, and then there'll be some consolidation. So I think it comes from a combination of developing and developing at a scale that we can scale up our business fairly exponentially. It's not a stretch to say we could do 10x what we're doing today as demand is there and as the industry proves itself to get to, you know, the large scale of companies like Prologis from a real estate perspective, or, you know, Lineage from the cold storage business. That comes from, you know, your own growth as well as consolidation of the industry.
Right. And I was looking up at the same time, there's 12,000 truck fueling locations in the US. In order of magnitude, that is many chargers still need to get on the ground. You mentioned that some of it will be organic from development within Terawatt. Some of it might be acquisitions or mergers. There are other players obviously looking at this opportunity, which is a great thing because we need all the efforts happening here. You mentioned this earlier that your current network is really centered around the I-10. In addition to some sites in ports and others, so that's the connection between California and Texas and it's a major transportation corridor. How do you think of the expansion beyond that corridor? And specifically, how do you think of competition? Because you probably don't want to be on the same corridor to a competitor developing it. So how do you think of this dynamic?
The federal government has kind of mapped out their plan for electrification of corridors. And a lot of the grants that are coming out now are very much focused on promoting those corridors. And so the federal government has laid out priority corridors and how they want this to scale in advance. And they're providing some funds. We were the recipient of, I think, the largest or one of the largest federal grants to develop corridor charging, almost $64 million for two sites in New Mexico that we're developing. There's another round of grants that's open now. They have identified critical corridors. Those will be the next that get developed just because federal grant money will be available to grow those. We own land on some of those corridors now. And I think that you mentioned that we were public in announcing we're going to develop the I-10 corridor. Corridors are going to be a little bit longer of the development cycle just because trucks that can make that route aren't available yet. And it'll be 2027, 2028. But given, you know, the development cycle of a site is 2 to 3 years, you know, you got to start now.
Yeah. And you need the full route as well to be ready, as opposed to the location you have right now where they're departing from one point and then coming back to it. If you're doing California to Texas, you can't have a gap in the middle, right?
Right. Or you can't build the middle of the bridge first. It's very much building a bridge where you need connect end to end to make that route work. But we are developing, you know, a lot of sites. We have the 6 on the I-10 corridor that we've announced that we're building. That's 6 of the 15 that we're developing. The rest are kind of in metro where demand is going to be sooner. And demand will always be because the trucks will run those routes. So you need both. And we have these, it's kind of like a hub and spoke that connects from areas like ports and intermodal facilities in Southern California, Northern California, Port of Tacoma, the Seattle area, Port of New Jersey, inland ports, like the big intermodal facilities in Chicago and Kansas City. Those will be drivers of kind of the hub of local routes. And then as trucks are starting to make the longer routes possible, you'll get the spokes that connect all of those along the corridors. We're very active in both.
Okay. And can you electrify by just focusing on one corridor? Because in the end, the fleets will work only in that corridor? Or do you need a broader charging network? And for a passenger vehicle, you need a broader one because sure, people might do San Francisco to Tahoe, but they'll do other routes, right? For a fleet that goes California to Texas, will they only do this? And therefore, if just the I-10 is electrified, that's enough for them? Or do they need the flexibility to also go on other corridors?
They will need the flexibility to do other corridors, but they have very set routes. There may be the local route we were talking about going from the distribution facility to the grocery store and back, you know, every day. There will be same routes from Port of Long Beach to Texas, Port of Long Beach to Phoenix. that are set routes that trucks will just go back and forth on every day. And the carriers of the goods have contracts to ship goods on those routes, especially when you're talking about port-driven or intermodal train-driven traffic. That still is on a fairly regular cycle and a fairly regular route. So as they begin to electrify their fleet, they may say, we're going to electrify this route. And they electrify the vehicles that run the same route back and forth all of the time. It's just a longer route. Then they would say, okay, now it makes sense based on infrastructure and range of vehicles to electrify this next route. So now we will procure vehicles that run that route. And so that's, I think, how things scale on a corridor level as well.
It's going to be a progressive shift for fleets that as they have corridors that are enabled to electrify, they will electrify their fleet for that specific segment.
Correct.
Okay. What are the barriers to growth for TerraWatt today? We talked about project management, right? Just making sure you have enough experienced people to actually run this very complex construction and projects. We mentioned capital could be one constraint in terms of having enough funding to build all the sites in parallel before demand comes in. Customer demand, the adoption of the vehicles might be one. Just curious to understand what is really limiting the growth of TerraWatt today.
I think limiting the growth of TerraWatt is the same thing that's limiting the growth of the industry. And that is number of vehicles on the road and electric capacity of the grid. And so I think that the others, if you are a successful business, you can scale. You can scale people. You can scale capital. If there's a sound business model there, those are the easier ones to solve. Getting enough vehicles on the road to scale the business, I think, is the biggest challenge today, is just having the demand for the product. And the vehicles on the road is largely driven by the cost of the vehicle. I think that there's a lot of people ready to adopt or ready to go from pilot to phase one and are being held back by the cost of the vehicle and the availability of the vehicle. When that solves, I think that demand will pick up. And then the challenge that will still be there is the capacity of the grid and how you get electricity to all these vehicles.
One last thing I'd love to touch upon is technology. What specific proprietary piece of technology does TerraWatt have? Because I understand that most of the equipment you're not developing yourself. These are things you're buying from supplier, the transformers, the charging infrastructure. You mentioned earlier that one of the key challenges on energy integration, making sure that you're able to do some energy arbitrage sometime with storage, making sure you're able to leverage solar and storage on site at times. Is there any energy management platform or capabilities that you've built at TerraWatt?
We are developing those. We have a very skilled team of energy experts that are looking at distributed energy resources, looking at on-site generation, looking at energy management, looking at variable interconnection levels from the grid where we can flex our sites up and down depending on what's available on the grid at different hours of the day. We're spending a lot of time on that now. Something that we've developed that is proprietary is our charge management platform, our charge management system. We call ours Twins. But that is really where the interoperability of the vehicles and the reliability of our sites are going to be a big differentiator. We have a hardware lab in Southern California where we are testing every charger, every firmware update against the vehicles. Customers can bring vehicles in and pair them with different chargers and test the interoperability. We have a network operating center. Our NOC operates 24/7. We can see the heartbeat of every charger in our network. We can do proactive preventative maintenance on our chargers based on, you know, the feedback we're getting in our software platform. We can tell if a charger isn't operational before a user can. A lot of fixes, just like your phone or your computer, is you turn it off, you turn it back on, and magically it somehow works. It's the same with chargers. With our network, we have the ability to do that remotely. So if there's something that goes down, we don't have to roll a truck and a technician that takes time and money. We stock spare parts for all of the equipment. So if someone drives over a handle on the charging cable, we have that in stock and we will know from our call center that that is where the failure was. And we can roll one of our mechanics and our technicians to the site and swap out the cable. We don't have to send someone to figure out what happened and then call and order the part and wait 3 weeks to get it and then go back and install it. Our response time for most issues will be under an hour. In most cases, our fixes on the long side will be 24 hours.
Right. And because back to this reliability topic we had earlier, which is you absolutely want to avoid having one or several chargers down, not just for revenue losses, but mostly because you have customers that depend on you for the business to operate.
Yeah. And we're seeing it now, especially on the light duty side, but more and more customers will have service agreements and levels of service that you have to deliver that come around uptime guarantees. We see it in the data center at five nines, you know, 99.999. We're not there in the charging world yet, but our internal goal is to be very, very high 90s, not quite to the five nines, but approaching on our reliability. Yes.
Just before wrapping up, I'd like to have a few quick round questions. I understand the whole project lifecycle is very complex. If you had a magic wand, what would you change today to make it easier?
Interconnection. At least knowing the power and how to get the power and where to get the power from is a huge step in our land selection process. And, you know, we'll find a land site and there's some public data that you can find on circuit capacity and substation capacity, but it's generally outdated because you don't know what's in the queue ahead of you. So it's not totally reliable. It's an okay indicator, but in a lot of times the data we get back from doing a power study doesn't totally match up with what's on the public maps.
What does it take for that? Is that just a data disclosure from utilities that we need?
So when we go to acquire a site, you know, we'll find the location and we'll come up with what our capacity on that site is going to be. And then we submit a power study to the utility. And it's typically a $2,000 study and takes about 60 days to get the data back for them to study that network and say, here's what we can provide you, phase one, phase two, phase three, and about timing to get each of that. They don't talk about cost of it. We have to make our own assumptions there. So just to get initial data back generally runs about 60 days from the utility. So as we're acquiring a site, so we think that we want this location and we think the maps show some power. Then you actually do the power study with the utility. 60 days later, they tell you what's available. But again, it's at that point in time. And until you submit your design, they don't contract for that power. So it's still at risk. So the process to locate power, understand the grid, understand time to get the power, and secure that power is a long and variable process. There is a way to simplify that and make it much more streamlined to find and secure power. It would aid the advancement of our site selection and site delivery substantially.
And every single company trying to interconnect a load on the grid.
Yes, is going through the exact same thing.
Maybe a single tool for the US with an automated interconnection study that responds in 24 hours.
Yep, and that is not data that the utilities want to give out.
What advice would you give to someone considering to transition to climate? What surprised you and what advice would you give to someone looking to go into this?
So I've always had a little bit of a slant to my career around climate sustainability. I was very early in the US green building and LEED certifications for buildings. I was very early in the rooftop solar development on Prologis and then a company I started after that. Similar at AIMCO with sustainability slant to developing, you know, our buildings. So sustainability has been kind of environment, climate has been a focus of my real estate, but in more mainstream real estate development. Coming to TerraWatt was really the opportunity to take things that I've learned from established industries and my tilt towards sustainability and all the development that I have done and the ability to build teams and to, you know, be able to build a company were all things that excited me about coming to TerraWatt. For people looking to get into climate tech, the climate industry, it's new. It's advancing rapidly. It's exciting. Be comfortable with change. Any, you know, emerging industry and startup company, you're reinventing yourself every 6 months as the industry changes, as the cycles change, as companies' needs change. So I would say if you're going to take that route in any emerging industry, but this one in particular, be comfortable with change because you have to be flexible, you have to be nimble to adjust to a very emerging product type, real estate classification and company.
Yeah. That's also what's so exciting about this space, that every month there is something new and emerging happening.
Yeah, you won't get bored.
No. You also come from a more corporate background. Prologis and others are a massive company. TerraWatt is technically a startup. Not many startups raise $1 billion after 3 years, but it is a startup. What advice would you give to someone transitioning from a more traditional corporate career to a startup world?
Same thing. Be comfortable with change. You know, big corporations, corporate world have very set ways that they go about doing things. So still there's lots of change here. There's lots of creativity. There's lots of critical thinking. As you reinvent the company every 6 months, as things change, roles and responsibilities change. Neha sent out an article to our executive leadership team about a year ago. And I think the title of it was something along the lines of "Don't be afraid to give away your Legos." And our roles change frequently in the company, and something that I was very focused on 8 months ago, maybe something around hardware selection, you know, we're building a team around. So I'm giving away those Legos to the next group that's coming to do that. So it will change. It will evolve. Being adaptable, being flexible, being a critical thinker is a very important trait to have here at TerraWatt.
If you were to work not at TerraWatt and not in heavy-duty trucking electrification, where would you put your energy and effort into?
This question was asked to me by someone that I worked very closely with several years back. She didn't like my answer, but I'll say the same answer: fishing boat captain.
That sounds fantastic.
Yes.
Can you combine this with your current role?
Maybe we can come up with electric fishing boats.
Right.
So, I like spending time out on the water. So that is where I like to spend time when I'm not at TerraWatt. If I was in the industry, I like real estate development. I like things with new sustainable twists to them, something that isn't the same thing every day. So something along those lines, either real estate development or fishing boat captain.
Fantastic. Well, Mike, thank you so much for the time. This has been fascinating. Really great to hear about how do you build a high power site, all the steps it takes, and now we understand the high cost and the time it takes to get them operational. Fascinating to understand better what interconnection really means. What does it take for the grid to upgrade and connect a new load? It was interesting to discuss the scalability of the business model, you know, understanding how large the sites are and therefore how much revenues and how many trucks they can actually serve. And also, what will it take to ensure widespread adoption of electrified trucks, both in terms of faster charging time and having more sites by TerraWatt and by others to really cover the entire US. So thank you so much for this discussion. Really looking forward to the first operational sites of TerraWatt and the next one to come after that.
Great. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Mike. Congratulations, you finished this episode. Thank you so much for listening until the end. And if you liked it, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a 5-star review. This is really helpful to be more visible in the rankings and to be able to keep inviting the best of climate tech entrepreneurs in this show. Thank you so much, and I'll catch you on our next episode very soon.